with Iraq and so on, affect for the most part the civilian population, and that's another example of how the Syrian population is basically surrounded and besieged in so many different ways. I also wanted to mention that, as your previous guest mentioned earlier, that today we are witnessing or celebrating the first anniversary of the Russian intervention. And we are organizing a number of revolt in more than 30 different cities around the world on October 1st to basically raise awareness and tell people what's happening. There will be revolts, protests, rallies, sit-ins, to basically try to break the siege around the Syrian revolution and tell people that the narrative that they're hearing about civilian war and intervention and so on are part of what is happening. The other part is the resilience of the Syrian population, its resistance, and the ongoing Syrian revolution with its creative dimension and what people are doing within different, in myriad different ways.
Yasser Munif, we want to thank you for being with us. Syrian scholar, professor at Emerson College in Boston, and Osama Nasser speaking to us from East Ghouta, Syria. We're going to continue this conversation and post it online at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. Our website is democracynow.org.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. The time is 5 o'clock. The evening news is next.
On Thursday, September 29th, from 8 to 10 p.m., Grassroot News will celebrate Fall 2016 with P-Funk as we get up for the downstroke with a deconstruction and celebration of George Clinton and the P-Funk All-Stars. Dr. Funkenstein and his contribution to music will be examined, as well as politics on the national and local level. So join me Thursday, September 29th from 8 to 10 p.m. for the Mothership Connection on KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Resolution Fest, October 1st through 8th in Portland. Resolution Fest is a week-long celebration of the people and communities reimagining the landscape of the tech industry. Over 8 days, the intersections of technology, identity, culture, community service, education, social change, collaboration, and creativity will be examined. There will be documentary screenings, a Women Who Code Portland Networking Night, a Hacker Lounge, and much, much more. Again, that's Resolution Fest, October 1st through 8th, all over Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, heavily armed sheriff's deputies made 21 arrests at the Standing Rock encampment in North Dakota yesterday. KBOO's Chris Andre spoke with organizer Jade Begay.
The draft environmental impact statement on the proposed coal terminal in Longview, Washington, is due tomorrow. KBOO spoke with the Columbia River Keepers and Climate Solutions about the path forward.
And 6 months after rejection by the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, a liquid natural gas terminal in Coos Bay, Oregon, is back on the table.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, September 29th, 2016. I'm Grace Ann Smith.
And I'm Sam Bowman. 21 people were arrested yesterday when riot police descended on the Standing Rock encampment in North Dakota. Video from the scene shows that as families prepared to stage a special ceremony involving grandmothers and children, heavily armed sheriff's deputies brandished assault rifles at the crowd. Tear gas and guns were used on indigenous water protectors in what was described by observers as, quote, a military-style show of force. Crop duster-style planes are shown in the video dropping what appears to be tear gas or mustard gas on the families. As riot police pull out what looks like automatic rifles, the crowds of protectors raise their arms and shout, "We are unarmed." Screams are heard as the officers chase down indigenous protectors. KBOO's Chris Andre spoke with indigenous organizer Jade Begay hours before the assault about the previous actions and what NGOs are doing to help the protectors.
I'll give a quick update on the last few actions that have happened these past few days. On Sunday, September, what was it? It was the 25th on Sunday.
Yeah.
Kind of lose track of time out here.
Yeah.
On Sunday, the 25th, the Indigenous International Indigenous Youth Council, in collaboration with the Red Warrior Camp and some other women leaders here on their ground, led an action at two construction sites out near St. Anthony, North Dakota. And I guess, like, first and foremost, it's really important for people everywhere to know that construction is still happening. The federal government did ask the company, the energy transfer partners, to voluntarily stop construction. However, that has not happened. They have not stopped. So they're out 20 miles away from where the camp is. Construction is still happening. Pipeline is still being laid out. And so every day, you know, the camps here are trying to organize actions to stop construction.
Where are these huge NGOs? Where's Greenpeace? Where are all the big heavy hitters who should be taking these companies to court? Who should be suing the state of North Dakota? These are blatantly illegal actions that are happening.
Right. That's a great question. Greenpeace has been on the ground. They left this past week. They've donated a solar truck that the media area is using. However, the truck is down right now, so we're figuring out ways to get it functioning again.
That was Jade Begay speaking from Standing Rock hours before riot police tear gassed adults and children and arrested 21 people.
Kelsey Warren is the CEO of Energy Transfer Partners, which is the corporation building the Dakota Access Pipeline. KBOO's Al Khan dug out four interesting facts about him. Kelsey Warren has a net worth of $3.9 billion, making him the 372nd richest person in the United States. In March of this year, Warren was named in a lawsuit after trying to foreclose on a cancer hospital in New York that he had invested in. Warren lives in the North Dallas Preston Hollows neighborhood, which banned home buyers of color until the year 2000. This neighborhood is also home to former President George W. Bush. Warren, in this campaign cycle, has donated $750,000 to GOP politicians, including the maximum legal amount to House Energy and Commerce Committee Chair Fred Upton.
Yesterday, OPEC surprised energy markets when its members reached a preliminary agreement to cut oil production. But don't start hoarding cheap gasoline yet. For more, I filed this report earlier today. Yesterday, the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries, or OPEC, tentatively agreed to reduce oil production in an effort to raise global oil prices. Prices crashed in 2014 from about $100 a barrel to $40. Basically, the world's oil producers, including those like the United States and Russia, who are not OPEC members, were producing way more oil than anyone wanted to buy. Saudi Arabia refused at the time to cut production, presumably hoping to gut the U.S. fracking industry and hobble its regional nemesis, Iran. But Iran's economy has weathered the low prices, at least according to Prime Minister Hassan Rouhani, as reported by Iran's Mehr news agency. And the U.S. shale gas producers have mostly made it through by reducing production costs and turning profits despite the low prices, according to Bloomberg News. The highest cuts proposed would reduce OPEC's numbers by around 750,000 barrels per day. The the OPEC nations have been meeting on the sidelines of the International Energy Forum in Algiers, and until yesterday did not give any positive signs that a deal would be reached. Yesterday's agreement thus came as a surprise to energy markets, according to oilprice.com, resulting in an admittedly modest and temporary price surge to $48 a barrel, a 6% increase. This shouldn't be taken as a true turnaround, though, because traders have reacted in one way or another to every sneeze that comes from OPEC since prices fell in 2014. And after yesterday's rise, skepticism set in almost immediately. First off, the deal is tentative and has not been implemented yet. OPEC member nations will meet again in November to determine how the cuts will be distributed among them. Of course, not every member of the oil cartel has the power and wealth of Saudi Arabia, and many are actually trying to ramp up production in the wake of conflicts and relax sanctions. Even if they can agree on who cuts what, it remains to be seen if the individual nations actually follow through and cut their oil production. Non-member Russia could also gum the works and halt rising prices. Russian Energy Minister Alexander Novak said yesterday that his country has no plans to cut production but would consider negotiating with OPEC if the organization follows through with its own cuts. Any rise in prices will also encourage shuttered U.S. shale oil companies to start producing again, and also encourage investors to put money back into the oil economy, thus allowing non-OPEC nations to flood the market yet again. According to industry news outlet Fuel Fix, shale oil firms in Houston are already celebrating. Says Andy Liepau of Houston's Liepau Oil Associates, producers here would be more than willing to get more oil out of the ground at $50 or $60 a barrel. For KBOO Evening News, I'm Sam Bowman.
Officials from Colorado are planning to visit Coos Bay, Oregon next week to propose a pipeline to carry natural gas from the Piceance Basin of western Colorado to a proposed export terminal in Coos Bay. The project is estimated to cost $5.3 billion. In March, Federal Energy Regulatory Commission rejected the proposed Jordan's Cove liquid natural gas terminal and liquefaction site in Coos Bay. At that time, the regulators cited concerns about potential negative impact on landowners and the environment, as well as a perceived lack of demand from Asian customers. But they left the door open and for a reapplication in the future if builders could demonstrate a need for the project. The Canadian government has recently approved the Pacific Northwest liquefied natural gas near Prince Rupert, British Columbia, citing competitive opportunity. Local government officials in both Colorado and Oregon are hoping to get the commission to reconsider the project and approve it this time.
Tomorrow, the draft environmental impact statement on the proposed Millennium Bulk Terminal in Longview, Washington, is due. It's been called coal's last stand in the United States. It is one among several environmental reports due on proposed massive fossil fuel infrastructure projects around the Pacific Northwest. KBOO News spoke earlier this week with Dan Sears of the Columbia Riverkeeper about what's on the table. We also spoke with Rebecca Ponzio of Climate Solutions about the big picture.
There is a lot going on, and these projects really exemplify the risk of fossil fuels. And new fossil fuel infrastructure that we are fighting because we do not believe this is the way we want to go into the future. They exemplify oil spills. They mean public health impacts, public safety impacts, threats to our salmon populations. So these coal and oil projects, although the fossil fuel industry keeps looking at us, Pacific Northwest, we are in the bullseye for them. We are fighting back, and we're not going to allow it. The public has spoken over and over and over again. And these final documents, be it the final environmental impact statement for Westway crude oil by rail terminal proposal, or the draft environmental impact statement done by the Army Corps for the Millennium Bulk Logistics proposal in Longview for coal, you know, these documents, we really hope that they do incorporate all the comments that the public has already put forth on the level of risk and the level of opposition. In terms of what to do first, looking at the just the sequence of events that we're staring at, this Friday we're expecting a final environmental impact statement. that will go to the city of Hoquiam on a crude oil by rail terminal proposal. Public comment has already been submitted over two different processes, and we do not have a public comment opportunity with this final environmental impact statement. But the city of Hoquiam, it's important that they hear, even though there's not a formal public comment process, that they hear how this project, which would have trains going all through the Pacific Northwest into Grays Harbor, so through Spokane, along the Columbia River, through the Columbia Gorge, which is the site of a recent train derailment, oil train derailment in Mosier, Oregon, that is the exact same route that these trains would go. And it's important that the city of Oakland hears from residents their concerns. And they can hear anytime. I would suggest starting now to make sure that that perspective is included in the final permit decision. In terms of the next piece, there will be a public comment period for the coal terminal proposal in Longview. And again, that takes the exact same route, but that, this time with coal. And coal trains that are, you know, have coal dust with them and lots of other contaminants that also are very dangerous to public health and our environment. And there's a more formal public comment process that will be held that people can engage in. And you can go to the PowerPass Coal website to get more information on how to be engaged on that process. And then for Tesoro Savage, this summer, this is the largest crude oil by rail terminal proposal in the entire North America. And this summer, there was a legal proceeding to present information on this, on the project. And all that information that was presented will then be wrapped up into a recommendation to the governor. And we're expecting that recommendation to come shortly after the election. So I would recommend that in addition to sending in comments to the city of Hoquiam, and you can find information about that at the Stand Up to Oil website, as well as the Army Corps process through the PowerPass Coal website, you also send information to Governor Inslee in terms of your concerns. That this is something, you know, these trains, an oil spill from these trains, an oil spill from barges or tankers, that impacts all of us. It impacts our economy. It impacts the fish that we have here, the salmon we have here, the oysters we like to go eat. And that's, these are things that our decision makers need to hear about that is of important concern, in addition to the climate impacts that these will have if they're actually allowed to move forward.
Yesterday, as protesters ringed City Hall, the Portland City Council backed off its plan to approve its new Portland Police Union contract. Mayor Charlie Hales ultimately moved to put off the vote until October 13th. Dozens of police accountability activists testified, none in favor of the contract, before the mayor moved to push back the vote. The proposed union contract includes a significant raise in the starting salary for officers, as well as the proposed elimination of the 48-hour rule that gives officers who have shot someone 2 days before they can be interviewed by officials about the incident. Eliminating the 48-hour rule is a major victory, but is not enough because many more reforms need to be enacted, police accountability advocates argued. One such issue is the use of video from police body cameras. The proposed union contract would allow officers to view the video before writing up their incident reports. Critics say police body cam policies should be formed with maximum public input, not by officials behind closed doors. As part of his decision to put the vote off, Hales pledged to listen to, quote, substantial input of police accountability activists. Concerned people are encouraged to call the mayor's office and give input on the contract. That number is 503-823-4120.
Activists from Don't Shoot Portland have come up with a plan B regarding Mayor Charlie Hales' broken promise to meet with them. The grassroots activists were protesting police violence when police got violent with them during their march last Friday, which was caught on video by Portland Cop Watch. Mayor Hales promised the protesters he would meet with them this week to talk about police violence, but when Don't Shoot Portland activists arrived for the meeting, City Hall was on lockdown. Many testified yesterday as the city council debated whether to approve the new police union contract. Last night, the activists camped in tents outside City Hall and erected a gigantic banner reading Black Lives Matter around the ornate building's rounded portico. Organizer Greg McKelvey said this afternoon that the group is holding their talk with city officials this Sunday, with incoming Mayor Ted Wheeler, joined by Bobbin Singh of the Oregon Innocence Project, NAACP President Joanne Hardesty, and others. McKelvey said they have also invited the Portland police officer who was commanding the scene last Friday when the police violence broke out. Tune in to the KBOO Evening News tomorrow night for an update on the meeting's time and location.
Body cam video of the fatal police shooting of a white 6-year-old boy killed in 2015 was released by a judge's order yesterday. The shooting drew second-degree murder and attempted second-degree murder charges against the two unnamed Marksville, Louisiana police officers who fired guns at a vehicle the child was riding in. The shooting happened after a high-speed chase involving police and the child's father, who had been seen arguing with his spouse. As officers tried to arrest the father, he jumped into a small car and sped away. The father was also shot but survived. The two officers are African American.
For the second time in 13 years, Alabama Supreme Court Chief Justice Roy S. Moore is on trial for a judicial ethics violation. The charges are the result of an administrative memo that Moore sent out in January, ordering the state's 68 probate judges not to issue marriage licenses to same-sex couples. Unfortunately, the Chief Justice's directive was sent out 7 months after a U.S. Supreme Court found that same-sex couples had a constitutional right to marry one another. In 2003, Moore had refused to remove a 3-ton granite statue engraved with the Ten Commandments, despite being ordered to do so by a federal judge. At that time, Alabama's judicial ethics panel removed Moore from office. In Alabama, state Supreme Court justices are elected, and in 2012, Moore defeated the incumbent Democrat to reclaim the position of Chief Justice. This has been a tough year for all three branches of Alabama's government. In July, Alabama House Speaker Mike Hubbard was found guilty of 12 ethics violations and sentenced to 4 years in prison. The Alabama House Judiciary Committee is currently considering impeachment proceedings against Governor Robert Bentley because of his alleged use of government funds to hide an affair with a former staffer. The wave of legal problems in Alabama has given a whole new meaning to the state cheer of Roll Tide.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for KBOO News In-Depth at 5:45, followed by Rose City Native Radio at 6. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather will be sunny with partial clouds, a high of 68 and a low of 50, with a 40% chance of rain at night. Today in history, in 1923, the British Mandate for Palestine and the French Mandates for Lebanon and Syria went into effect, laying the foundation for the current system of nation-states and conflict in the Middle East. And in 2008, after the collapse of the Lehman Brothers and Washington Mutual, the Dow Jones Industrial Average fell by 777 points, the largest single-day loss in its history. The quote of the day is from Mariam Defensor Santiago, a crusading Filipina politician who died today from cancer. She was known as the Iron Lady of Asia in recognition of her fierce, lifelong fight against graft and corruption. She once said, "Handbags, I don't like them at all because they occupy my hands. My hands always have to be ready in case I need to slap somebody."
It's 5:23. Time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
In a mind-boggling trick, some magicians levitate themselves. But remember, the key word in magic trick is trick. Scott Walker, for example, is quite the political trickster. This right-wing extremist became so unpopular in his first term as Wisconsin's governor that he faced a recall election in 2012. Yet, He seemed to rise in front of our very eyes, magically lifting himself up above the public's anger to avoid defeat. How'd he do that? As reported by the Guardian newspaper, some 1,500 secret emails, court testimonies, and financial records were recently uncovered, revealing that Walker had a hidden lifeline of corporate cash hoisting him up. Despite a Wisconsin law specifically prohibiting corporations from funding political candidates, millions of those banned dollars were pumped into the Gov. The trick is that the corporate checks were sent to supposedly independent political outfits that, thanks to the Supreme Court's ridiculous Citizens United decree, are allowed to take unlimited campaign funds from corporations without disclosing the names of the donors, provided that the independent groups do not in any way coordinate their electoral efforts with the campaign of the candidates they want to elect. Even if obeyed, this farcical rule essentially sanctions organized corporate corruption. But Walker and company didn't even try to obey it. Rather, the governor asked everyone from the Koch brothers to Home Depot to Donnie Trump to funnel checks to the independent political groups backing him. He wrote personal thank you notes to the donors and even had his media strategists handle the ads for both his campaign and the groups. This is Jim Hightower saying, Scott Walker, his front groups, and his corporate donors aren't a magic act. They're debauched thieves stealing our democracy to impose their plutocracy over us.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Despite publicly vowing to maintain the Cuban embargo for as long as Castro is in power, Donald Trump authorized the spending of $68,000 there in 1968. The money was spent during a visit to Cuba by executives of Trump hotels and casino resorts, who are apparently exploring investment opportunities on the island. At the time, it was strictly prohibited for an American or a U.S.-based company to spend any money in Cuba without prior approval from the Office of Foreign Asset Control. There is no record of Trump's company applying for or receiving such approval. The money was funneled through a company called Seven Arrows Investment and Development Company, who instructed Trump executives on how to make it appear legal by linking the expenditure to a charitable effort. The candidate has not yet commented on the allegations, but his campaign manager, Kellyanne Conway, did not deny the accusation. She commented that Trump had indeed spent the money, but done nothing illegal, since he ultimately made no investments in Cuba. Hillary Clinton has accused Trump of breaking the law, and Florida Senator Marco Rubio has said, quote, it was a violation of American law if that's how it happened.
Wells Fargo CEO John Stumpf and Kerry Tolstedt, the executive who ran the retail banking division of the banking giant, will have to forfeit significant portions of their salary in a decision announced yesterday by the bank's board of directors. Stumpf will forfeit $41 million and Tolstedt will forfeit $19 million in stock awards. Both will also give up any bonuses for 2016, and Tolstedt will lose any severance associated with her retirement. The board apparently took the action to stem the increasing public and governmental backlash after the bank admitted that over 2 million bogus accounts had been created. The fake accounts resulted from a hyper-aggressive sales plan instituted by Tolstedt that required employees to sell as many as 15 new bank products per day to achieve their sales quotas. Products included everything from new accounts and credit cards to retirement accounts and mortgages. CEO Stumpf has now endured 2 days of blistering bipartisan cross-examination. Last week, before the Senate Banking Committee, and today in front of the House Financial Services Committee. In today's session, Texas Republican Roger Williams commented on how little Stumpf appeared to know about his business and bluntly asked him when he was going to resign. California Democrat Maxine Waters stated that Wells Fargo was too big to manage and that it should be broken up. On Wednesday, California State Treasurer John Chiang announced that the state would suspend all business with the bank for a period of 1 year as a penalty. Chiang controls California's $75 billion investment pool. Wells Fargo stock price has dropped to a 2.5-year low as a result of the scandal.
The Justice Minister of Turkey announced yesterday that the Turkish government has taken action against 70,000 people in the wake of July's coup attempt. Of those, 32,000 are still in custody, he says. Even these numbers may be low. Human Rights Watch estimated that as of a week ago, 100,000 teachers and public servants alone had been suspended or dismissed from their jobs. The overwhelming target of the Turkish president, Recep Tayyip Erdogan's retribution, are members of the Hizmet movement, a religious organization led by the cleric Fethullah Gulen, who has been in exile in the Pocono Mountains of Pennsylvania since 1999. The Turkish government, which labels Gulen a terrorist, has repeatedly called on the U.S. to extradite him. The U.S., through Vice President Joe Biden, has so far refused to do so without a thorough legal proceedings based on any evidence Turkey can provide. For his part, Gulen last week called for an international commission to investigate Turkey's claim against him and placed the blame for the coup squarely on Erdogan's shoulders. KBU reporter Sam Bowman spoke last month with Tolga Tanis, Washington, D.C. correspondent for the Turkish newspaper Hürriyet, for more about Gulen, his movement, and their role in Turkey's recent history.
In what you've observed in your career, how would you characterize the relationship between Gulen himself and the Gulen movement's relations with the Turkish state?
The relationship between Fethullah Gulen himself and the Turkish state is going back to all the way to the 70s, when he was a young imam in Turkey. He was very political at the same time, and he was against communists in Turkey, and he tried to establish kind of community for himself. And during that time, since 70s, he started to build his community in Turkey, and he was supported by some elements within the state all the way back to the 70s, since all the way back to 70s, as I said. But at the same time, it's a very complicated relationship, because the Turkish democracy history is seized by several coup d'etats in Turkey, unfortunately. I mean, the military was always dominant on the Turkish democracy, and they interfered several times with the Turkish politics. And this young imam was always forced to take a side in this kind of interventions. In the 80s, for example, there was a warrant for against him after the coup d'etat in the 80s, but the proof that he had some connections with some elements within the state, was unable to catch him during 5 or 6 years. He was able to escape from the state, and it's not an unusual thing, especially under the control of the military, with the tough rules conducted by the military officers in that time. So he was supported by some elements within the state when he was building his organization, no doubt. And he was always trying to stand with the state during that time. When, for example, there was another coup d'etat, postmodern coup d'etat, with a coup d'etat which was made, but not by using the tanks, but some political pressure imposed to the politics in 97. Fethullah Gulen, for example, supported this coup, and his followers supported the some generals who are oppressing the ruling party that time. But then the things turn out differently, and when this general in 1997 turned against him, he had to escape from Turkey, and he immigrated to U.S. In 1999, he came to U.S. with the reason of some health problems, but the real reason was the oppression that himself and his followers were experiencing in Turkey during that semi-military regime. So his relationship with the state, as I said, is quite complicated. He started to his community by getting support from the state, but during that time, since his ideology is at the same time as a religious ideology, he was targeted by some elements within the very same state. I mean, some elements that supported him, some elements within the state supported him, but other elements sometimes targeted him.
About how big of a movement is Gulenism within Turkey?
There is some expectations, I mean, there's some assumptions on this issue. maybe 2 million people are followers of the movement, but the important part of the movement, his influence is much bigger than his the number of his followers, because they are at the same time dominating an economy in Turkey. His followers are very influential on the Turkish economy, Turkish politics, etc. So maybe 2 million people, regular people in Turkey, but all the businessmen, all the followers who were working for the state is giving much bigger influence for the movement within Turkey.
And in your article, you described a conversation you had 20 years ago during that 1997 coup with a guy you referred to as Mr. X, who was involved in the government, and he gave you some revelations about how the Gulen movement organizes within the Turkish government. And could you just outline briefly for our listeners what you learned from him about that?
Because, I mean, I was a young reporter at that time during the 1997 coup, and this guy, Mr. X, came to us to give information about the network of the organization, network of the Gulenists. It was quite shocking for me, because what he told us, it was new to us. I mean, this guy was responsible for the students who are preparing to get in the military schools. He said that this is a special mission, even within the... this is a secretive organization, by the way. The students, you don't know how they are working. You don't know the network of this movement. And even if it's secretive, what Mr. X was doing was much more secretive than the usual structure of the movement, because it was a special division within the movement, as he described to us. And he was meeting with all the young students in age 10, 12, 13, something like that, to teach them for the military school examination. And once they get in, once this student achieve in this examination, sometimes not to be called, they were ceasing their relations with the students, and they were not seeing them within during years. But the thing is, they were picking some loyal students, and they were preparing them for the examination secretly, and after years and years, they were recontacting them, and they were instructing them in terms of the orders that the high-level people within the movements are giving. So that was quite shocking for us to learn how they are working.
In the last month or so, the Gulen movement within Turkey has come under some a bit of a crackdown from Erdogan's government. Is there any proof currently that Gulen or the Gulen movement was involved in the coup attempt in July?
There are several testimonies which is showing some quite concrete evidence that some followers were involved with this coup. Some high-level Gulenists, some Gulenist soldiers, Gulenist military officers, etc., were involved with this coup. But the thing is, it is hard to prove for the Turkish government to show an evidence that Fethullah Gulen himself ordered them for this kind of coup attempt. So it's a really tough task for the Turkish government to show this evidence to U.S. to request the extradition of Mr. Gulen. So far, we saw several testimonies showing the ties between Gulenists and the coup, but nothing so far about Fethullah Gulen himself. And they sent several documents to the U.S. government for the extradition request on Mr. Gulen, but U.S. officials also said that these documents are not related to the coup attempt. So right now the Turkish government is working on it. We will see what kind of result will arise from this work, but so far we don't know any concrete evidence between the coup attempt and Fethullah Gulen himself. We have evidence for the followers, but not for the Fethullah Gulen himself.
Thank you so much for speaking with me today.
Thank you for having me.
For KBOO Evening News, I'm Sam Bowman speaking with Tolga Tanış, a Turkish journalist who is the U.S. correspondent for the Hürriyet newspaper. The Independent Middle East Media Center, or IMEMC, reports that the Israeli army intends to flood the Gaza border areas with water in order to destroy underground tunnels built by the Palestinian resistance. An Israeli military official told Ma'ariv newspaper on condition of anonymity that the army plans to flood underground cross-border tunnels, as Egypt has done on its border with Gaza. 60 miles of land extending along the border of Gaza will be flooded with water, according to the official. He added, according to the PNN, that Israeli army would also finish within a few months the building of its underground concrete wall to block attacks from Gaza.
And now, the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine and from the International Middle East Center Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center at www.imemc.org for Monday, September 26, 2016. One Palestinian injured, more than a dozen others kidnapped during Israeli invasions targeting West Bank communities. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. One Palestinian was injured, six others kidnapped by Israeli troops as they invaded the northern West Bank city of Jenin, searched many homes and property. Medical sources said that the soldiers shot a young man with a live round in one of his legs, while many Palestinians suffered the effects of tear gas inhalation during clashes that took place after the army invaded the city. The clashes erupted in different neighborhoods throughout the city after the soldiers invaded them and started searching homes. Elsewhere, Israeli soldiers invaded on Monday at dawn at the Al-Isawiyya town in occupied East Jerusalem, searched several homes and kidnapped five young Palestinian men. Moreover, the Palestinian Prisoner Society, PPS, in Ramallah in central West Bank has reported that Israeli soldiers have kidnapped on Monday at dawn three Palestinians from Beit Rima town, north of Ramallah, while one of the Palestinians from the town was kidnapped near Bethlehem. Also on Monday, Israeli soldiers invaded several areas in the southern West Bank district of Hebron, searched homes and kidnapped three young Palestinian men, in addition to bulldozing an agricultural land in Beit Umar town north of the city. In the Gaza Strip, Israeli soldiers stationed across the border fence with the coastal enclave opened fire into Palestinian lands and a number of homes in Khan Yunis in the southern part of the Gaza Strip. In addition, Israeli Navy ships opened fire on Palestinian fishing boats close to the Gaza shore, forcing the fishers to go back to shore. And that's all for today from the IMEMC News. This was the Monday, September 26, 2016, news roundup from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by George Shmawi and me, Ghassan Banoura.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Ray Bodwell, Al Kahn, and Chris Andre. The producer is Sam Bowman. Special thanks to Free Speech Radio News and Unicorn Riot. Our engineer is Matthew Olson. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Lisa Loving. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at KBOO News. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Grace Ann Smith.
And I'm Sam Bowman. At 7, coming up on Monday morning on KBOO. At 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, on Positively Revolting Talk Radio, hosts Ani and Lynn hold a conversation with community organizers Teresa Rayford and Maria Garcia. At 9 on Political Perspectives, Teresa Mitchell interviews journalist and author Susan Faludi about her new book, In the Dark Room, her inquiry into the meaning of identity in the modern world and into her own saga involving her 76-year-old father who underwent sex reassignment surgery. At 10, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints, investigative news radio with Dennis Bernstein. And at 11, on the Radio Zine, host Dan Johnson speaks with Max Mizcotti, director of Sage Metro Portland, working to enhance the lives of older LGBT community members and the upcoming Sage Expo. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support for KBOO Community Radio in our recent fall membership drive.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
How many people are killed by the police? Davey D. spoke last week with a childhood friend of Terrence Crutcher, killed last week by police in Tulsa, Oklahoma.
Davey D., Hard Knock Radio, hanging out with you this afternoon. And yesterday was a very tragic day in American history. Six people around the United States were shot and killed by police. Within 48 hours, that number has increased even more. And in the past month, 67 have been shot and killed by police, 15 of them black. The most egregious of these shootings involves Lamont Scott, who was in Charlotte, North Carolina, where we saw uprisings as a result of that. And the other is in Tulsa, Oklahoma, with a gentleman by the name of Terrence Crothers. I have an old friend on the line with me who is very familiar with that city. She grew up there, and she knows who Terrence is. And I wanted to get a